Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Juvenile Life Sentences Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 20, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Jackson v. Hobbs and Miller v. Alabama. The question in both cases is whether a sentence of life in prison without possibility of parole, imposed for murder committed when the defendant was only 14 years old, constitutes cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the 8th and 14th Amendments. To discuss the case, we have John Stiniford, who is an assistant professor at the University of Florida Levin School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Stiniford.
This is John Stiniford from the University of Florida, and I'm going to talk today about two cases that are currently before the Supreme Court dealing with the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, the cases of Jackson versus Hobbs and Miller versus Alabama. In these cases, a particular question was presented to the court. The question was whether a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for someone who committed murder when he was 14 years old violates the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishments. Now, the defendants in these cases have some things in common. They both grew up in an atmosphere of severe poverty and abuse. They both had a prior history of acting out to harm themselves or others. They both had problems with drug abuse. And each defendant committed the murder that resulted in a life sentence when he was 14 years old. Now, of the two, Evan James Miller committed the more horrific of the two murders. He had a plan to steal baseball cards from the victim. But when this plan went bad, Miller attacked the victim with a baseball bat, beating him over the head until he could no longer get off the floor. Miller and his friend then stole $300 from the victim's wallet and set the victim's trailer on fire. The victim died in the fire, apparently of smoke inhalation. That's the facts from Miller versus Alabama. Contrell Jackson, on the other hand, appears to have been convicted of murder based on a theory of complicity liability. In that case, the case of Jackson versus Hobbs, Jackson and two of his friends attempted to rob a local video store. One of Jackson's friends apparently brought a shotgun with him. Jackson was supposed to act as lookout, but did end up coming inside the store. When the store clerk refused to give the boys any money and threatened to call the police, one of the boys shot her in the face and killed her. But apparently, Contrell Jackson was not the shooter. He was merely one of the robbers and was convicted of murder based, again, on complicity liability. For the legal analysis, the petitioners are trying to argue that it's unconstitutional to impose a sentence of life imprisonment without possibility of parole on anyone who's under the age of 15. And the petitioners in this case rely primarily on two recent Eighth Amendment cases to support their argument. In 2005, in Roper versus Simmons, the Supreme Court held that it was unconstitutional to execute anyone under the age of 18. Because minors are still developing physiologically and psychologically, the court held that they're less culpable than adult offenders and are also better candidates for rehabilitation, and therefore it's inappropriate to execute them. Similarly, in 2010, in the case of Graham versus Florida, the court held that it's unconstitutional to impose a sentence of life imprisonment without possibility of parole for a non-homicide offense committed while the offender was a juvenile. The court relied on essentially the same reasoning as the Roper court regarding juvenile development. That is, juveniles are generally more impulsive, less reflective, less morally responsible for their conduct, and also more amenable to rehabilitation than adults. And therefore, the court in Graham said that you could not impose a sentence of life without possibility of parole, at least for a non-homicide offense. So now, the petitioners in the current cases want the court to extend the reasoning of Roper and Graham to prohibit sentences of life without possibility of parole for all juveniles, including those convicted of murder. Okay, so they want to extend Graham to cover juvenile murderers. Alternatively, if the court's not willing to go so far, the petitioners argued that life sentences without possibility of parole should at least be unconstitutional for young juveniles, that is, for people 14 years old or younger. And they also argued that for older juveniles, juveniles ages 15 to 18, that it should be unconstitutional for a statute to require mandatory sentences of life without possibility of parole. That is, they argued that for the older juveniles, judges should be able to make an individualized determination based on all the facts in the case relating to the offender's culpability and ability to be rehabilitated. Finally, one of the two defendants, Jackson, argued that the court could make a constitutional distinction between juveniles who actually performed the killing and those who were convicted based on complicity liability, like him. Now, in making this argument, Jackson drew some support from a 30-year-old case called Enman versus Florida, in which the court held that it was unconstitutional to execute a person for murder when he was neither the actual killer nor played any role in planning the killing. So there's at least some chance that Jackson could get a ruling in his favor in this case, even if Miller loses, because Jackson did not actually perform the killing, unlike Miller. Okay, now, these cases together, as well as the other recent cases the courts decided under the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, really illustrate the inadequacy of the Supreme Court's current approach to the question of cruel and unusual punishments. The court's current test involves basically two prongs. First, the court asks whether there's a societal consensus against a punishment, and then if the court finds such a consensus against the punishment, the court is supposed to exercise its own independent judgment to decide whether the punishment is nonetheless acceptable. Both prongs of these tests are really inadequate to deal with constitutional questions. First, regarding societal consensus. As a factual matter, there is almost never a societal consensus against a punishment that reaches the Supreme Court for review. The primary indicia of social consensus or societal consensus are legislative enactments and jury verdicts. But any case that reaches the Supreme Court will involve a punishment that was authorized by at least one legislature and imposed by at least one judge or jury. And, of course, if you have that sort of authorization and imposition, that's powerful evidence that society, at least a big part of society, still approves of the punishment. In fact, in the present case, apparently a supermajority of states currently authorize sentences of life without parole for juvenile homicide. Although such sentences are quite rare for offenders who are 14 years old or younger, this rarity appears to be at least partly the function of the fact that it's rare for 14-year-olds to commit murder in the first place. So to the extent that there are any objective indicators of current societal consensus, they tend to point in the direction of societal approval of this punishment, not disapproval. But that was also the case in the Roper and the Graham cases, where you had large numbers of legislatures approving the punishment and a fairly consistent pattern of juries imposing the punishment. And yet, nonetheless, the court found a societal consensus against those punishments. The way it did so in those cases and the way it would do so in this case, if it does, be to simply pretend to find a societal consensus against the punishment. For example, the court might say, well, although lots of legislatures approve the punishment, juries hardly ever impose it, and because it's so rare, we think society really disapproves of it. Again, you can only reach that conclusion if you ignore the fact that 14-year-olds rarely commit homicide. But nonetheless, there's a good chance the court will go in that direction if it decides that it wants to eliminate this punishment. The second question, of course, is whether the punishment is unacceptable in the court's independent judgment. Now, regarding this issue, it's anybody's guess as to what the court will do. One could logically extend the reasoning of Roper and Graham to cover this case. I mean, after all, if juveniles really are less culpable and more amenable to rehabilitation than adults, then it would seem to make sense to give them at least the chance for parole, even if they've committed murder. On the other hand, the court in Roper and Graham explicitly noted that life without possibility of parole was available for juvenile homicide offenders. This fact helped the court justify its decision to eliminate the death penalty for juvenile homicide offenders and also to eliminate life without parole for non-homicide offenders. And so the court may not want to go further down this road. It may want to say, you know, we've gone this far in protecting juveniles, but we don't want to go any further. But of course, this points to the second inadequacy of the Supreme Court's current approach to the issue. Why should it matter what the court wants to do? If it's interpreting the Constitution, it should reach the result that best reflects the meaning of that document. But of course, the court is not interpreting the Constitution in these cases. It's merely imposing its own will. The independent judgment prong provides no constitutional standard to guide the court beyond its own preferences. Now, an oral argument in this case, a number of justices appeared to be leaning towards making mandatory life without parole sentences unconstitutional for minors. In other words, the sentence would still be available. It would still be possible to sentence a minor to life imprisonment without possibility of parole, but only after an individualized determination by a judge or jury. A number of justices seem to be leaning in this direction. This possibility is interesting because it might signal a willingness by the court to return to the original meaning of the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause. As I actually have argued in a couple of articles, which you shouldn't read, you'll enjoy them very much, cruel and unusual actually has a particular meaning. It means cruel and contrary to long usage. In other words, it means cruel and new. The idea underlying the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause is to prevent legislatures from authorizing punishments that are unduly harsh in light of longstanding practice, particularly common law practice. As Justice Scalia noted during oral argument in these cases, the common law contemplated that the jury would make decisions as to the appropriate punishment in each case. Until the 1990s, the universal practice in this country was not to move juvenile offenders into the adult system and thus make them subject to life without parole unless there was an individualized determination that this was an appropriate thing to do in light of the interests of the offender and of society. The current wholesale movement of juveniles into the adult system is new. In fact, it's the result of a public panic in the 1990s about super predators that never turned out to materialize. So it's a new practice, and it's much harsher than the practice we followed in this country for a very long period of time. So if the court ends up requiring individualized determinations in cases involving juvenile homicide offenders before they can be sentenced to life without parole, it just might possibly do so for the right reasons. But I wouldn't hold my breath.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.